Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. It's been a minute. I know I am going through a lot right now. I'm just going to kind of tell you guys what's going on in my personal life a little bit so that you know why I'm going to be so sporadically posting on the podcast. So we are moving. We are selling our house. We are downsizing into one that I think will be a lot easier for me to maintain. And so in the midst of all that, this all kind of happened really quick. I've been wanting to downsize for a really long time, but nothing has, you know, come up until recently. There was a house that we all felt was perfect. And so we are going to be moving. So anyway, that said, I am usually the one that takes care of our yard, our pool, and our house. And so I have to get all of those things ready to, you know, of course, list our house. And so I have a lot on my plate right now, in addition to all of this. So where you can find consistent information is Facebook. So I've been posting to Facebook somewhat frequently. If you look for True Crime Kelly on Facebook, you'll find my page. But I usually post the articles, you could say, like the written posts about what's going on in the Corey Richens trial. I've also recorded some videos just recapping the Corey Richens trial, but this is a chance for me to actually sit down and tell you guys all about it. So in case you don't want to sit and read a whole novel of, you know, trial coverage, then, you know, this is for you. As always, I appreciate you guys being patient and graceful and understanding when I have, you know, times like this in my life. I do everything for the podcast by myself. I don't have any kind of assistant do any kind of writing or research for me. I do all of that myself. I do the recording, I do the editing and the uploading all by myself. I could, of course, use an assistant. I just can't afford it. So what you get or what you see is what you get. So that said, let's get into the Corey Richens trial. It is ongoing right now. It's expected to last, I think, 4 or 5 weeks. I've been watching diligently, and I plan on still watching and listening while I, you know, get my house ready and all of that. So real quick, we're going to start with day one. As we know, Corey Richens is accused of murdering her husband, Eric Richens, by poisoning him with a lethal dose of fentanyl back in 2022. Her alleged motive was to inherit his money to pay over $4 million in debt that she had racked up, collect on his life insurance, and then start a fresh life with her boyfriend. I am actually going to be reposting the episode that I originally did on this story. And so if you want to catch up on that, then I'll go ahead and post that first. And then I'm going to post each day of the trial one by one. I think that's probably the easiest way to do it. I'm going to try to, you're probably going to get like an influx of like 10, I think I have 10 days so far of trial coverage. And then I'm going to try to catch up and, you know, continue covering it. But for now, we'll stick with day one. We'll do these daily recaps. So the trial is presided over by Judge Richard Mrazek in Summit County, Utah. Watchers of the trial love his kind, super polite affect and his voice. He's got a really deep voice and people seem to love it. So the jury is comprised of 12 people, 8 main jurors, and 4 alternates. There are 24 seats for the public and 10 for the media. Now, Corey Richens' defense attorney is Catherine Nestor. She is also representing Tyler Robinson, who is the man accused of killing Charlie Kirk. In opening statements, the Summit County Deputy Attorney Brad Bloodworth is the lead prosecutor and said in his opening statement that the evidence will prove that Corey Richens murdered Eric for his money and to get a fresh start at life. So they are framing the state's theory about motive and alleged planning. Prosecutors walked jurors through the text messages, the internet searches, the behavioral evidence that they planned to present, including body cam footage from first responders that showed Corey Richens and her emotional state after discovering her husband. Now, the state framed Richin's later self-published children's book on grief as suspicious, given the timing and her promotional appearances. And the state pointed out that Eric's inheritance was over $4 million, and Corey believed that she would get it all as long as they were still married, according to their prenuptial agreement. Considering their marital issues and consideration for divorce by both Corey and Eric, the state believes that the timing suggests that she killed Eric before he had a chance to divorce her so that she could still inherit his money. We can also expect to hear about concerning conversation that she had with her boyfriend, as well as incriminating searches that she made on her phone. Wait till you guys hear about these. My favorite one is luxury prisons for the rich. She actually Googled that, and I found that one to be hilarious. A few things that were also revealed during opening statements is that before Eric died, Corey booked an all-inclusive trip to the Caribbean for her and her boyfriend, Josh Grossman. They were expected to check into their resort just 1 month after Eric died. And my question when I heard that was, how would Corey have pulled that off if Eric was still alive? That, to me, just adds more to motive, because obviously, she expected to have that done by the time they were going to go on that vacation. Like, that's just where my mind went. But the state presented text messages that she sent to Josh that read, quote, "If I were divorced right now and asked you to marry me tomorrow, you would? I just want to lay on the couch and cuddle you, watch a murder documentary, and snuggle," end quote. The murder documentary choice is bold, I'll say that. Then 5 days after Eric died, like a female Scott Peterson, she texted her boyfriend and said, "Babe, I miss you. I want you today, every day, not just sexually, but physically, mentally, every day when I wake up. I do want to be together. I do want you. Live our life out together. If he could just go away and you could just be there, life would be so perfect. I love you. I don't know what my deal is today. I'm sorry," end quote. Now, mind you, her husband had just died. The father of her children had just died, and she's texting her boyfriend. Just let that sink in. Now, the state also presented that on Valentine's Day, Corey bought Eric a sandwich from the Mirror Lake Diner and left it for Eric before she left to go meet up with her boyfriend an hour away. Eric texted her and said, "I'm going to lay down for a bit. If I don't start feeling better, I'm going to head to the hospital." Shortly thereafter, all activity on Eric's cell phone stopped for nearly 90 minutes in the middle of a busy workday, which is very out of character for Eric. And we'll come to find that, you know, we'll learn more about Eric as we meet his friends and his coworkers and his family. After those 90 minutes, he called his friends, and his friends recall Eric sounding somber, scared, and confused. A few days after that, Corey called her friend slash drug supplier, Carmen Lauber, and asked if she could provide her with something stronger. Then it was time for the defense's opening statements. The defense countered that they expected the evidence will show a very different picture, that Eric may have died of an accidental overdose due to a lawful prescription medication that was tied to chronic pain or Lyme disease, but not intentional poisoning. They emphasized that there is no direct evidence showing that Corey poisoned her husband, and that her behavior after his death should be seen in the context of shock and grief. Defense lawyers also underscored that two previous motions, including to change the venue due to pretrial publicity, were denied by the judge, setting the stage for the trial to proceed with the current jury panel. Catherine Nestor began opening statements for the defense by playing the 911 call of Corey telling dispatchers that her husband wasn't breathing, as well as showing body cam footage of EMTs working on Eric while Corey kind of paced around the house with her face in her hands. I'll play a piece of that 911 call so you can hear it for yourself.
911, what's the address of the emergency?
My husband's not breathing. He's cold.
Okay, what's the address?
282 Willow Court.
282 Willow Court.
Uh-huh.
Okay, what's the phone number in case we get disconnected?
435-671-4987.
Okay, it's going to be in Francis.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
I don't know. I was sleeping with my kids.
Okay, I can't understand you. I need you to take a deep breath. What's going on?
I don't know. I was sleeping in with my kids. I just came in the bed, in our bed, and I turned over, and he's just cold. He's just cold.
Who's cold?
My husband. I turned the light off.
And he's not breathing?
No.
He's not breathing?
No.
I need you to confirm it for me. Is he not breathing?
No.
Okay, we're going to... Can you do CPR?
No.
You don't know. I'm going to tell you how to. Are you willing to do CPR?
Yeah.
Okay.
During her opening statements, Catherine Nestor explained that they had just been celebrating on the close of the Midway Mansion, which we will be hearing about this place a lot. See, Corey was a house flipper, and she had dreams of purchasing this Midway Mansion, this huge, sprawling estate that had been abandoned before the construction was completed. Her goal was to buy it, clean it up, finish the construction, and then sell it for a massive profit. Corey said she got a good deal on it and believed that she could make at least $2 million in profit for her and all of her investors. Eric's business, which was called C&E Masonry, he was a stones, like he did masonry work. His business was also doing very well. In fact, in 2020, he claimed over $750,000 in income from the masonry business that he owned. On March 3rd, Eric sent text messages to Corey saying that they needed to have some celebratory shots. So around 9 p.m. that night, they had lemon drop shots, and Corey made Eric a Moscow Mule drink. And at 9:30, Corey left her phone in the master bedroom and went to sleep with one of her boys, who apparently suffered from night terrors. At around 10 p.m., Eric talked on the phone with one of his friends, who recalled Eric sounding totally normal. At around 10:30 p.m., Corey's phone was unlocked, reportedly because Eric was in the habit of checking Corey's phone because they had some serious trust issues, for good reasons, we will learn. And according to the defense, when Eric died, it was pretty clear that he had died in his sleep. His phone and Apple Watch were on their chargers, and there was an empty pill bottle on the nightstand next to Eric's bed. This pill bottle actually expired back in 2016, which the defense is really going to try to drive home. Now, at around 3 a.m., Corey woke up and went into the master bedroom, where she found Eric cold, and then she called 911. The medical examiner determined that he had been dead for several hours before EMTs arrived. There was no fentanyl found in Eric's bedroom, but Catherine Nestor points out that nobody ever searched for it. The Moscow Mule cups were never collected or tested. The scene was never secured. The housekeeper was actually there the very next day and put the cups in the dishwasher. Corey was interviewed repeatedly, and her phone calls were tapped by investigators, but her story never wavered. So the defense wants to suggest that Eric struggled with chronic pain and that Eric would ask Corey to buy him pain pills because prescriptions for oxycodone are typically around 10 milligrams per pill. And if you want something stronger, you either have to get a special prescription or you can buy it on the streets. Catherine Nestor says that back in 2022, the dealer where Carmen Lauber got pills for Corey only sold oxycodone, not fentanyl. So that was the rest of the opening statements. And then we got into our first set of witnesses. There's going to be a ton of witnesses throughout this trial, and I will try to break down each one and just basically what they have to offer to either the state or the defense. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now, let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing: homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day. You can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's time4learning.com.
At Great Wolf Lodge, there's adventure for the whole family. You and your pack can splash away in the indoor water park where it's always 84 degrees. There's a massive wave pool, a lazy river, and tons of water slides for your pack to enjoy together. And the fun doesn't stop there. Get ready to explore and play at adventure-packed attractions from Magi Quest, a live-action game that takes place throughout the lodge to the Northern Lights Arcade. There's also a bunch of great dining options and complimentary daily events like nightly dance parties, all under one roof. And the best part? With 22 lodges across the country, you're always only a short drive away from adventure. So bring your pack together at a lodge near you. Book your stay today at greatwolf.com and strengthen the pack.
The first witness called to the stand was Eugene Richens, Eric's father. He says that Eric was only 39 when he died. Eric helped his dad on their cattle farm. He loved to be outside as a kid and as an adult. He was an avid hunter, outdoorsman, and family man. He was devoted to his children and his family. The Richens family was extremely close. They saw each other multiple times a week. They phoned each other daily. Eugene and Eric were even planning on buying a cabin together. And then Corey called Eugene on March 4th of 2022 and told Eugene that Eric was not breathing. He rushed to Eric's house, and at that point, his sister Katie was also there. Eugene said that while he was at the house that morning, Corey wouldn't talk to him or look at him. And then days and weeks later, Corey told Eugene that she had heard from the medical examiner that Eric had died from a fungus in his lungs, the same way that his mom, so Eugene's late wife, Linda, had passed. Well, there's a problem with that because Eric's sister, Katie, called the medical examiner to confirm this, and they told her that Corey had never called and that the results hadn't even been released yet. So then Eugene was released and Katie took the stand. Katie Richens Benson is Eric's sister. She loved Eric like a best friend, more than a brother, and she has been a very vocal advocate for her family. She, I feel like, has been representing the family for the most part. Her and Eric were extremely tight. They talked all the time, even if it was about mundane things or extremely personal, sensitive things. For example, one time Eric was hit by a softball and he called Katie at 1 o'clock in the morning to tell her about it. He was open about his use of testosterone, and he was also open about the issues in his marriage to Corey. Very few things, if anything, were off limits to discussion. Prior to Eric, Katie actually owned the home that Eric and Corey were living in. She sold it to them, which will become kind of a sticking point later on. We'll get there. But Katie testified about the night that Eric died and how emotionless Corey was. She said, I observed she was not how she normally was when we would go on overnights. She was very well put together. She had a matching pajama outfit on. Her hair was done up. She wasn't crying like I was. She just stood there and shook her head no at me. When asked when she should tell the boys that their father had died, Corey seemed very detached, and Katie said that the boys were distraught. One of them had just watched from the windows his dad's body being wheeled out of their house, and he was extremely upset. When Katie told Corey that the boys saw that, Corey turned to her mom, Lisa, and said, well, I guess we better tell them. After she told the kids, one of the sons became really upset, and Katie went to check on him multiple times. He was on his bed with covers pulled up, and Katie sat on the bed and tried to console him, but he wanted his mom. So Katie told Corey that she should go in and console him. She told her this multiple times, and finally she said, quote, Corey, I'm not his mom. I'm not his dad. He's very upset. I cannot console him. Can you please come in and talk with him? Now, it was around this time, while Corey is consoling her son, that Corey's brother's fiance, Brianne Sorensen, asked Corey about the closing of the Midway Mansion. Katie could not believe that Corey was still even considering going to close on the house that day. Katie told Corey, you can't tell me you're going to go close on the Midway Mansion when my brother just died. To which Corey responded, yeah, the money went through. Your brother has nothing to do with it. I'm going to. This is like, you know, rephrased by Katie, but that's essentially what Corey said. Now, what Corey did not anticipate was finding out that when Eric died, despite being married to Corey, the house was actually in a trust that was controlled by Katie once Eric died. Eric never told Corey that he set this up. So imagine Corey's surprise when she figures all this out. Then Katie testified about the funeral arrangements. There was a family meeting held the day after Eric died. They decided Eric would be buried beside his mom. They discussed who would speak at the funeral and who would be pallbearers. Then at the end of the meeting, Lisa, Corey's mom, dropped a bombshell on the Richens family when she said, "When are we going to talk about Eric wanting to be cremated?" Corey appeared to be shocked, but then said, he told me he didn't want any bugs crawling on him when he was dead. It creeped him out. Katie asked, well, then why did we just plan an entire funeral based on a casket if now they're bringing up cremation? And the interesting point here is that there have been allegations, rumors, you know, chit chat about Corey's mom, Lisa Darden, allegedly poisoning one of her exes or, you know, past relationships, but kind of getting away with it. And I will get into that in future episodes, but I think it will add an important context because this is Corey's mother. And she's the one who's like, when are we going to talk about Eric wanting to be cremated? Well, it just all makes too much sense. So then the defense begins their cross-examination. They begin talking about the trust Eric created. Nestor gives Katie a document, and the document is Eric's living trust that made Katie the trustee if Eric were to die. Corey was a beneficiary of that trust, and so were the boys, but Katie's role as the trustee was to administer the funds and carry out her brother's wishes. Catherine Nestor asked Katie if she had been paid by the trust, and Katie explained that she is allowed to be paid by the trust for her time, but that she has never taken a dime from the trust. So there will likely be more questions about the trust and Katie's scope within the trust, but to stay within the scope of this cross-examination as it pertains to the direct examination, they kind of tabled that for later, I assume. I think they were just kind of laying the foundation because they did mention that she is going to be brought back to the stand at some point. So then Nestor asks Katie about her testimony regarding the night that Eric died. Katie had testified that Corey was in a sweatsuit, like a matching pajama set, with her hair done up, and that she had never consoled or hugged Katie while she was there. But Catherine Nestor poked holes in that by showing body cam footage of Corey in her pajamas, and they do appear to be actual pajamas, but they're like a matching plaid jersey knit type set. And there's video of her bending down to hug Katie while Katie is inconsolable on the floor. Then Catherine asks Katie if she was aware that Eric used THC gummies occasionally. Katie affirms and iterates that despite their mom being largely against drugs, they did not consider THC to be a drug or like a narcotic. So they were, you know, open-minded about his use of gummies. There is also talk about a private investigator and some handwriting samples, which I am sure we will expand on in later days. But Katie says that a woman named Brooke Harrington was hired by the estate and Katie paid her. Brooke was a financial accountant and was paid $14,625. We will hear from Brooke later on when she takes the stand, but Brooke left for a new job after Corey was charged. Katie says she did not speak to the prosecutors before Corey was charged. It seemed to me like Catherine Nestor was kind of trying to portray Katie as out to get Corey, kind of like she was, you know, spearheading this like witch hunt to get Corey. But Catherine Nestor asked Katie why she sent a timeline to investigators. And Katie responded that it was because she was not an investigator, but felt like Eric's death was suspicious. Then on redirect, Bloodworth asked about the civil lawsuit and who filed it. Katie says Corey filed it against Katie as the trustee. This is a completely separate issue and civil case. So these are two separate, you know, cases within the judicial system. What we're dealing with during this trial is a criminal prosecution, whereas the civil matter is totally different in regards to the trust and Corey suing Katie for what she believes she is entitled to within the trust. So it's a totally separate thing, but it is easy to get confused because we're talking about that case in this trial. So we're kind of like commingling them. But Katie says Corey filed this suit against Katie as the trustee, but Katie says that Corey forged Eric's signature on a HELOC of $250,000 without Eric's knowledge. Eric also found a bunch of credit cards in his name that he was unaware of. And so I think Katie is alluding to the fact that Eric was becoming aware of Corey's spending and the way she was racking up debt and debt that could potentially destroy Eric's life and his business. And that he was, you know, becoming very concerned about that and meeting with the divorce attorney. And, you know, we will get into all of that. But after that testimony, Katie was excused. And from this point on, she is allowed to stay in the courtroom, which is not typical. But because she is the representative for the family, she gets to stay in the courtroom, despite the fact that she will probably get called back to the stand later. That typically doesn't happen. If you have a witness that is, you know, that testifies, but is not totally excused, they are not allowed to sit in the courtroom and watch because it could prejudice their testimony or their opinions of the case. So next on the stand was Clint Benson. This is Katie's husband, Eric's brother-in-law. He works as a realtor as well as a real estate assets manager for Salt Lake City. So after Eric's death, Clint had a locksmith come into Eric and Corey's home to change all the locks, and he hired a security guard to watch over the house until they were able to get cameras installed. Clint testified that he had taped the doors so that he could tell if any of the doors had been opened. He also had sensors placed throughout the house that could pick up, you know, even the smallest amount of movement. Clint testified about hearing a phone call between Eric and Katie that was on speakerphone back in November of 2020. During this phone call, Eric was very upset. Clint had pulled up the Summit County Recorder's website where he pulled up the parcel information on their property. And that is when he found a $250,000 home equity line of credit or HELOC taken out against his own house. He told Eric this, and at this point, divorce was discussed, and Clint recommended a divorce attorney. On cross, defense attorney Wendy Lewis asked Clint why, you know, he was corresponding with a divorce attorney on Eric's behalf, and he said that it was because he knew Corey would be looking at Eric's emails and did not want Corey to find out that he was considering divorce. Lewis also asked Clint if the private investigator they hired to investigate Corey was paid for by that trust that was supposed to be for the Richens boys, the three sons, to which he confirmed yes, and this PI was paid $100,000 from that trust. So again, I feel like this is the defense's attempt to prove that the Richens family was determined to pin all this on Corey as part of this greater vendetta against her. But I also get it, because if this was my brother, I would be doing the exact same thing. So I'm not saying that in defense of the defense. I'm just kind of giving you what I think they're trying to achieve towards this jury, who we should believe knows absolutely nothing about this case. So the next witness on the stand was Patrol Deputy Vincent Nguyen. The state reviews the body cam footage from the night that Eric died and asked about his interactions with Corey that night. And the biggest takeaway from his testimony, in my opinion, was that he was responsible for the crime scene log and the death checklist at the scene. So he was looking for anything that might explain Eric Richin's death, but he says that he did not see any THC gummies in the home. He did not see any illicit drugs or drug paraphernalia in the home either. He also says Corey's affect was bizarre and that she sounded like she was crying, but did not actually see any tears. So then on cross, he was asked how many times he had seen Corey in a state of shock or distress, and he had said none. You also have to remember that at this point, during the body cam footage, like in that moment, nobody is assuming, you know, the police have no reason to suspect that Corey might have poisoned her husband. They don't even know how he died. At first, the medical team, you know, the EMTs that showed up thought that maybe it was an aneurysm. And so they were kind of like throwing things at the wall, but nobody really assumed right off the bat that he had been poisoned, except maybe Eric's family. But I think also the defense is going to try to poke holes in the investigation, just as a way to ruin the credibility of the investigation by pointing out that, you know, the cups weren't collected or tested and the death checklist wasn't actually abided by in like the proper protocols. And so I think they're going to try to just create doubt by pointing out all the flaws within the investigation. That wraps up day one. And in the next episode, we will wrap up day two. Thank you so much for sticking with me. I'll see you soon.